All right. Hello, everybody. We are really excited to welcome Richard Bird to join us today. I will run through a few housekeeping items and then we'll get started. We're going to talk about identity and security, and I know that's a topic that we're all very interested in, and I think I had a chance to do a little bit of reading up, and I think you'll enjoy his presentation style as well. So just to remind everyone as we sort of set the intention for today, that we are all bound by a code of ethics and professional conduct, and that we are all here to better the world of credentials, the world of identity, and the world of security. We're all working towards the same goals. Anyone is welcome to participate in these calls, but if you plan to be a contributor or you want to get more involved, then I really would encourage you to fill out and sign the IPR agreements, which links can be found to those in the agenda for today. And it's very simple to join, and we definitely want to have your voice here at the table. Let's see. Also, we do keep a recording of this call and also notes in the transcript and chat. So please feel free to put notes in the chat. And if you would like to ask a question, that's how we'll be managing the discussion today. So put Q+ in the chat if you have something you'd like to ask Richard. If you or Q- if you want to remove yourself from the queue. And this is the section of the agenda where we get a chance to meet new folks. So if you are joining us for the first time and you'd like to introduce yourself and what you're working on and what your interest is in credentials, we'd love to hear from you. And if you haven't been here for a while and you just want to sort of give a verbal hello to everyone and let us know what you've been up to, we'd invite you to do that now as well. So, go ahead and put yourself on the queue if you'd like to introduce yourself. All right. Next is announcements and reminders. Does anybody have anything coming up that they want to talk about? Something that is important for the community to be aware of, now is the opportunity for you to share that. Dimitri, I'd like to put you on the spot, if you don't mind, to kind of give a little 30-second update on the VC-EDU PlugFest discussion from Monday, and maybe it also will serve as a teaser for when you all are going to come and talk to this group about it in a couple of weeks. You're very muffled. Like if you're not loud enough.
1 second.
Okay, is this a little better?
Oh, that's perfect.
Okay. So a couple of things. So we just had the first pre-discussion about the third Jobs for the Future Foundation, so JFF PlugFest, which is going to be testing requesting verifiable credentials from wallets. So the first one tested display of VCs, second one tested issuing. This one is going to be testing verifiers requesting multiple credentials from wallets. The PlugFest itself is going to be held on October 9th, so the day before IIW. So the discussion about the exact details, like what we're testing and how, is continuing. So those are just the broad terms of what we're focusing on. So we encourage everybody to join the discussion that's coming here to the CCG shortly, that Kimberly mentioned, and further calls on the subject on at VC-EDU. How's that?
That was perfect. And I will grab the link for those of you that do want to participate in the PlugFest. I'll grab the link that you need to fill out, but I think Dimitri, is the deadline June 6th, June 8th, something like that? It's in the link, so I'll put the link in the chat in just a moment. Anybody else with a reminder or announcement? Thank you, Sharon. The deadline is June 5th. And Sharon, if you have that link handy, you can certainly post it in the chat for us. Thank you. All right. Well, let's get right to the main agenda, which is Richard Byrd, who is the Chief Security Officer at Traceable AI. And as I was preparing to have Richard come today, I was thinking a little bit about this group and how I feel like, and this is just sort of for Richard to know, we're a group of about 500 folks. And as a community group, I think we really, everyone is interested in credentials, but one of the things I've found being a part of this community is that folks really come at it with sort of one of three lenses. They're either like me, sort of very interested in credentials and how people can tell their story of their life and experience through credentials, or they come at it from a security, how do we keep these things secure? Or they come at it from an identity lens. And so I think it's really great to have you here to kind of give us your perspective on identity and security. And with that, I will let you take it away and let us know. If you have things you want to share, you can certainly go ahead and should be able to go ahead and share now.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for the opportunity to be with you. I'll talk a little bit about my inspiration, motivation to do so in just a second, but let me go ahead and get the presentation that I pulled together up on the screen. And Kimberly, if I can ask, can you see it?
I sure can. It looks great.
All right. Fantastic. It looks like I'm going to have to dual screen here. So hang on for just a second. All right. So let me say, first of all, I'm really eager to talk with you all today, for a number of different reasons, but the most important reason is because of how long I've been associated with identity. I'm going to make some disclaimers. First of all, I'm not a technical presenter. It doesn't mean that, you know, we can't go in the weeds and JSONs and JOTs and OIDC and AuthZ and AuthN. I've worked around all of these components and aspects for, you know, years and years. But my presentation style and my presentation approach tends to be on picking apart myths and misconceptions and misrepresentations that all of us, particularly those of us that work in the field of identity, you know, whether it's in the credential space or verification, validation, access control, that we have to labor with all the time. And I think that there's a really interesting reason why that's the case, and it has to do with the fact that we're one of the few security domains that really doesn't know much about our history, which I'll talk about a bit today. I do like interactive, you know, conversations versus me just verbal vomiting all of this information out. And I will say, as we get to the close of the presentation, it's another day, which means it's another airport and another sprint to a different city for me. And I'll give some background on why that's the case. You know, so as we wrap up, I'll definitely be looking to tie things up, let you get back to the remainder of the meeting conclusion, and I'll be hitting the road. I've subtitled today's discussion as A Problematic History in Three Acts. And I think for folks that have, like W3C, CCG, you know, people that have a specific interest in credentials, that have a specific interest in the association of credentials to decentralized identity and other, you know, frameworks, I think that it's really important to understand the distinction of the three acts of the history of identity. Now, if I dive in a little bit, you know, first of all, why even listen to me? I always think it's important to have at least some kind of credibility statement. You know, it may not be as much credibility as I would like, But I hope that, you know, I give you some reason to think about something in a new way today. And the reason, you know, that I feel like I'm able to do that in most of my presentations, is just simply because of where I've come from and my experience. Now, when I say I go way back in identity, I do remember that my first identity project, without even recognizing it was an identity project, back in my late 20s, was a Novell eDirectory to Microsoft Active Directory migration. That wasn't actually the thrust of my IT career at that point. I was working for a company that was just simply doing that migration. They didn't have anybody else to do the job, and so I put my hand up and said I'd do it. But the first part of my IT career was actually in IT technology management. I spent 20 plus years, actually 24 years in the corporate world. And my first track was in IT operations, so middle office and back office in the banking industries. So I did a lot of application development, release management, QA, UAT, all of those, fun parts. The good thing for me from a security standpoint is that I was the guy that used to break all the rules. I actually remember my first information security head before we had anything like CISOs. Who came to me one day and said, "Hey, we gotta, stop your production code deployment because you've got security vulnerabilities." And I can distinctly remember saying, and this is terrible, but I distinctly remember saying, "You didn't pay for this application; the business did. We'll go to production, and we'll note your, we'll note your findings as opportunities for future features and enhancements." Wrong thing to say, obviously, then, but we weren't as knowledgeable about the bad outcomes as we are now. Certainly the wrong thing to say today. Unfortunately, I wish I could say it's changed, but it really hasn't changed as much as we'd like to, or like it to have changed. I was actually brought back in after CIO to be in a role that I think is helpful for this conversation. The role that I'm most known for in my career is not my CISO or CIO position. The role I'm most known for is creating the largest centralized identity function back in the day at J.P. Morgan Chase. I ended up leaving Chase after 11 total years as the head of global head of identity for all of the consumer businesses. About 350,000 employees, 72,000 contractors, 2.something million functional and machine accounts, and those are only the identities that I certified every quarter. That's why I know those numbers so well all these years later. So obviously I spent a lot of time in banking. Most importantly for me on the professional side, was pulling the cord and getting out of the corporate world. And that liberated me, actually gave me freedom to speak, which I've now done 600 some odd times in the last 7 years. And I've, held multiple C positions now on the solution side of the equation. A caveat about my presentation, please forgive the traceable template. This presentation is not about traceable. This presentation is about identity. Unfortunately, I keep all of my work on a single work laptop. And I didn't want to grind out, a brand new template for this presentation. I have been quoted extensively, and globally, for years now. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Dark Reading, kind of all of the interesting media outlets, both on the business and the technology side. And also for this group, I do have some background in having sat and served on standards committees, been associated with NIST, been associated with open banking accords in the UK as well as EU and Australia. I am one of the folks that sat on an ABAC committee years and years ago. So I've definitely spent a lot of time in this space. Now let's get right into the meat of the discussion. I had mentioned that one of the things that I find challenging about making progress in identity as it relates to security is that we are the only domain that has no knowledge of our history. And I think this is really important for discussion because I did research, and it's interesting how thin the amount of information about information security is out there. Nobody's actually really done much in the way of academic studies or even popular studies around the history of information security. And if I launched a number of dates of probably the most significant breaches, exposures, or events that have happened in cybersecurity and just mentioned The dates and the timing of those events, most people, even just in cybersecurity, have no idea what those events are from a historical perspective. But it's even worse on the identity side. Let me give you an example of this. This is a great picture. You know, those of us that go back to the days of tape, you know what this is. This is a mainframe operations room, probably from the early 60s. I still am fascinated by somebody that's doing compute wearing a suit. But because usually it's a Grateful Dead t-shirt these days, especially if you're in the mainframe space. But the situation that we have is where did identity start? And identity did not start at the very beginnings of compute. ENIAC, as an example, really didn't have any concept or a framework of access control beyond physical keys. You know, so if you are familiar with the ENIAC system in the late 40s through the early 60s, you know, the first major compute system, and you actually accessed it by turning it on or turning the console on with a physical key. It wasn't until 1961 or 62 that the construct that would become identity as we know it today would be introduced. And this is a really fascinating part of our history, because it not only got introduced, it created what now has become the dumpster fire that is identity. So if the mainframe was the beginnings, the current middle state of where we're at in evolution and growth, unfortunately, is the dumpster fire. And I'm going to give you some really specific reasons why that is as we go through this presentation. I want to come back, though, to, you know, the beginnings of when identity became a notion within compute. And it was 1962. And in 1962, and I don't read slides, I tend to wave my hand at them and maybe talk about what the picture is. So you're more than welcome to read the Wired quote yourself. But in 1962, IBM has embarked on a massive installation of a new mainframe technology at MIT. And at MIT, the graduate students that were associated with the equivalent of what would have been CIS today, from a degree standpoint, but actually was engineering back then, they were in a bit of a pickle, because they needed a number of hours per week to be able to access the mainframe system and be able to do their coursework, right, or their research or their studies. So this introduced the necessity for CTSS, or computer time sharing system. And the CTSS system was actually developed by MIT, and it assigned accounts and passwords to the students. Now, here's what I think is really, really important to understand about. Great, we introduced account and passwords. This was the very beginning of identity as a notion within the digital world. It is so persistent as a framework and structure, we still use it today, no matter how bad it sucks. And how bad does it suck? Well, the early days of this particular event should have already given us the lessons that we needed to have done better. And by that, I mean, it took approximately, depending upon whose story you listen to, it took approximately 11 hours for Alan Scher, and specifically, to figure out that he could go scrape the entire password log out of the system and then begin to sell compute time to his fellow students. So, you know, really the foundation of identity in all that we do was shown to be problematic within a half a day of it being introduced as a structure. And yet we continue to build on this idea of identities and passwords. And even if you think about it, the foundational notions of a directory, right? It was in the form of an access control log or access control list back in 1962. But functionally, it was a directory. It was a student named assignment to each of these password and account components. It was centralized in one location. So everything that has come since was built off of a foundation that was understood to be a challenge or a problem from the very beginnings. And yet we didn't stop. We rushed on towards greatness in building these. Now, I would really strongly encourage, I always like to make the disclaimer, I am not being paid for any of the the endorsements or recommendations that I make. The only book that I'm aware of that produces a fairly decent history of information security, I would actually like to have seen it on the threat side as much as I saw it on kind of the standards and laws and different activities that were done around information security, which is really where a vulnerable system puts its emphasis. But a vulnerable system is really a must read for anybody in information security. It gives us a anchor to our history, and it helps us understand how things are the way that they are today because of foundational practices or behaviors that we established 20, 30, 50, even 70 years ago. So if I can encourage you to read anything new, I'm actually on my second read through on it. I would definitely encourage you to grab this book. So let's talk about the three acts. I had mentioned that we were going to cover identity and its relationship to security in three specific acts. And there'll also be, the next slide will be a bit of a talk about where we're at notionally and from a maturity standpoint against these acts. But if we think about some of the things that I just talked about in the mainframe, in the origination of mainframe access administration, the first act of access that has lasted a very long time and actually continues to persist is access administration. Now, the important thing here is that these are things that have been continuously and constantly and inaccurately associated with security. And I think it's unfortunate because if you are an identity practitioner, you labor either explicitly or implicitly with the burdens of an entire population of people who think that access administration is access control or security. And within that population are people like your own heads of business and, you know, directors and CEOs and, you know, all the different people who believe, you know, what my corporate CIO believed a long time ago when I was asked to take over access at JP Morgan Chase. I remember the day that I got promoted and I walked in, still a young man with much less gray in my beard at that time. And I walked in and my corporate CIO at that time controlled a $2.5 billion IT budget. And he stuck out his hand and he said, "Congratulations, you've got the easiest job in IT." And I looked at Chris and I said, "Why would you say that?" And he goes, "Well, it's just giving people access to stuff. How hard can it be?" Now, for folks like us all in this organization, or in this presentation today, that both sounds absurd and painfully accurate in terms of our interactions with people who have some interesting assumptions and expectations about what access really means from an identity security standpoint. So when we look at this first act, these are common terms and common constructs that we are all faced with today in managing identity in any given organization. Accounts and passwords obviously are the very root, just like we talked about as it related to 1962 and MIT and CTSS. Along came Federation and SSO. Now, Federation and SSO are directories actually before, so I'll get back to that in a second. When we look at Federation and SSO, I have spent a good close to 20 years with a lot of conflation of security and Federation and SSO. And Federation and SSO have nothing to do with security. And I think that the disconnect there is fascinating to me because, you know, even in the identity security practitioner space, we push heavily on Federation and SSO. But from an operational standpoint, Federation and SSO yields a better end user experience. We all remember the days of 27 accounts and passwords that we needed to remember in order to get into each of the 27 key critical business applications or technology interfaces that we had to work with, right? Obviously, Federation and SSO made that a lot easier. Security obviously comes into play relative to Federation and SSO. We can apply security over Federation and SSO, right? In theory, then, we're doing a one-to-many application of security to all of the applications and processes that are in that Federation and SSO space. But there was a time when a lot of people thought that their identity programs were done because they'd already federated or single sign-on the majority of their critical and high business applications. Unfortunately, the reality of the curve of cyber crimes and losses clearly shows that Federation SSO didn't get us to the Nirvana security state. And directories. Now, directories are always fascinating to me because I'm a very, very big fan of decentralized identity for a number of reasons that are probably too broad to discuss in today's presentation. I do think that one of the significant hindering factors in achieving identity security is this strong tie that we still have to directory-based and directory-born systems. And it's frustrating because when you look at the way that directories were originally developed, particularly for, say, Microsoft Active Directory, directories were never actually built for identity security. Active Directory and Azure AD's primary Achilles heel to this day, after nearly 40 years, is simply that Active Directory was built specifically to share files and give access to printers. That is the root history of Active Directory. It's the root history of directories in total, which is access to assets, not control of the accessor to those assets, that has really stymied innovation and growth. And it also has made conversations about decentralized identity very difficult because directories are so rooted in our architectural frameworks that when we start to talk about decentralized identity, the assumption by our colleagues in, say, in architecture or any other technology trades, the assumption is that decentralized identity introduces complexity because we're fragmenting the associated components that would be in a holistic directory. And that's not even going into a deep dive on the security implications of, the risks of aggregating all of your accesses into a single directory format. But that's the, kind of the laundry list of items that were really the core creation of access administration, along with some color commentary on how it's been problematic in terms of our growth and our innovation in identity for security. But then along comes access control. With access control, we start to see things like strong authentication, right? The rise of 2FA to MFA, and we're not here to debate whether or not it's strong enough authentication. Sad fact, MFA deployment in the enterprise is somewhere near 13 to 14%. We have not yet even crossed the line of 25% of enterprises using MFA effectively. It's been a very slow adoption curve. Can it be fished? Of course it can be fished. The problem is that I see people arguing not to do MFA in the enterprise because of all of this, conversation about, it still could be co-opted. It still could be taken over. I don't care what argument you make. It's still way better than account and password. Unfortunately, the 2FA MFA debate has created some interesting problems, but there's a reason for it, because even if you do an exceptionally good, strong authentication, flow for your users from an access control standpoint, it introduces at least a small amount and sometimes a larger amount of friction. And this is where we begin to see the massive tensions between access administration and identity and security. Because the instant that we start talking about introducing friction, people freak out. Now, this is inconsistent with security in the entirety of the rest of our lives. Security in the entirety of the rest of our lives, specifically in the analog, requires effort, right? I can't just think about my security system at home turning on when I go to bed. I have to engage in some form of action in order to make that security happen. However, in the digital world, because we've had access administration for so long, we have simply put our users in a space where they are conditioned to expect easy. And when easy is available to users, the downside is easy is available to the bad guys. Won't belabor that point. You already understand exactly what I'm talking about. You will see some additional components in access control that are interesting, but burdened with some challenges as it relates to operational execution, such as step up and step down dynamic authentication, specifically. Step up authentication. Was expected to deliver a tremendous amount of value, and then we found out that it's extremely difficult to execute. And the reason is because authentication is coarse-grained security. It is not fine-grained security. Authentication begins to tip into fine-grained security, and authorization tips fully into fine-grained security, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. But because it tips into fine-grained security, most of our systems have no underlying capabilities to support step-up authentication. So then we're stuck in a space where we're driving it with rules and policies. And if you work in a rules and policies-focused organization on the security side, you already know what I'm about to say, which is rules and policies are a tremendous amount of overhead the more and more of them that you have. And managing and controlling those policies becomes not just a full-time job, but usually a full-time staff. And so as we've tipped into finer-grained aspects of access control, we've started to see the limitations of Act Number 2. We've seen the beginnings in access control of the conversations around decentralized identity and that's not SSO, that's SSI. My apologies for the acronym. Self-sovereign identity. I would say that if there's anything that's happened in access control that's pushed the conversation of security further recently, at least at the conceptual and theoretical level, within the access control space, it's been the introduction of DID and SSI. Now, that's not to say it doesn't come with some challenges, right? DID and SSI are problematic in terms of execution and operation for a couple of different reasons, some that I already highlighted, which is they go heavily against current state architectures and current state frameworks as it relates not just to security, but to identity as well. So it requires a substantial mind shift by people to begin to understand how do you create decentralized identity constructs that service an operational population. And self-sovereign identity is even more problematic because I think SSI has been stuck in a muddy rut recently. Well, not just even recently, probably the last 4 or 5 years. Because SSI has gotten a bit off track in this world of what I would call not political in the sense of parties and you know, kind of the dynamics in the United States, but political in the sense of who has ownership of their identity, how much of their identity do they have ownership of. And I'll put a fine point on this. I talk to a lot of SSI people, and they tell me, well, you know, human beings should have complete control over all aspects of their identity. And my response to that is usually, do you have any family member who is, perfectly capable and is a full-grown and functioning adult, but you don't trust them with any significant decisions? Those are the same people that we're suggesting have the capacity and capability to have full control over their own identities. And it's problematic as well in that large parts of our identities are not defined by us, right? The way that I like to say it is I can't walk into JP Morgan Chase and declare myself to be a private client customer, right? A private client customer has criteria on the amount of deposit dollars you have. Do you have a private banker? Do you have all of these different pieces of your identity that are associated to you by JP Morgan Chase, not by self-declaration? So like I said, access control is really, kind of where we've gravitated to from maturity. There's a ton of access administration that is the reality for a large part of companies today, especially applications that can't do federation and SSO. But we're really kind of firmly in this access control space. And finally, the third act, which is the act to come, and it's the act that we're currently in, layer 7 access. Layer 7 access is where we start to talk about the details of API access, fine-grained control, OSI and authn, elimination of implied and persistent trust for identities. I think I have successfully scrubbed all references to zero trust and tried to focus specifically on layer 7, because layer 7 is an accepted notion in our layered security models. But the elimination of implied and persistent trust is obviously a ZT type statement. And I'm going to talk about that in some detail as I go forward here. So let's talk real quick about the villains in each act. I know that, I'm burning time here pretty quickly. Let's talk about the villains. First of all, access administration is not security. Full stop. It is not security. It is a space where 80 to 90% of the enterprise world is still stuck, and where there's this assumption and expectation that it is security, but it is not. Access administration goes back to what that corporate CIO told me. It's just giving people access to stuff. How hard can it be? And in fact, giving people access to stuff intentionally or unintentionally is probably one of the easiest things in technology. But it's super easy to give people access. Matter of fact, the correlation of theories is problematic in this space because taking access away from people is extremely hard. But giving to them is extremely easy. Access control is only security when it is implemented across the entire digital estate and it's fully dependent on the quality of that implementation. So access control is strongly impacted by weakest link risk. If we think about, all of the access related breaches in the last 20 years, the bad actors just simply found the weakest link. And now that weakest link has moved to the human user relative to phishing and ransomware and that type of, activity. But the bad actors always are able to find the weakest link because access control is not distributed across the entire digital estate. I work with a gentleman that runs a really well-known pen testing organization, and he says, all I have to do is keep trying. I will always find a way in. And that always find a way in is not the same as it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when we get hacked. That's always find a way in because there's always something in our digital state around identity that has not been secured correctly. It raises the possibility that maybe if we actually secured identities, we would see less breaches. Different conversation, different time. Layer 7 access, much like the DID SSI statements that I made around access control, layer 7 requires major rethinking around our security architectures. It puts identity in a primary position instead of assets and data. And if you look at the vast majority of security architectures and deployments in companies today, they put assets ahead of identity. And because they put assets ahead of identity, all I have to do is be you and I get your stuff. So the rethinking necessary for layer 7 access security is only just now beginning. And I'm only seeing movement in a handful of companies. For those of you that are, in the DevOps world or the DevSecOps world, this is not my statement. This was something that I picked out of a very interesting read that I will also encourage you to take a look at, which is identity is very rarely first in our hearts in the technology world. This comes out of a very fascinating paper called The Tragedy of the Commons. I will read the red label part about the introduction of 2FA against open source security registries. This simple measure could prevent 99.9% of account takeovers, a rising threat to open source security. However obvious this measure seems, the new mandate resulted in outcry from the development community. Authors of extremely popular objects threatened to quit doing OSS registry updates if they were forced to do, oh my God, 2FA, right? And this is in the last 2 years, folks. This is not something that goes back a decade ago, right? This is our own technology community saying, if you put as much of a you know, as of an iota of friction in my experience, I am going to just simply not play anymore. And unfortunately, this is the reality of where we're at with identity today. This is the reality that we're at as it relates to credentials, as it relates to verification, as it relates to validation. Anytime we try and introduce anything that improves security, we run into a significant percentage of population that not only doesn't like that friction, they will find ways to work around it. So the tragedy of the Digital Commons, like I said, I definitely encourage you to read this paper. It was actually a fascinating deep dive into security problems with a strong orientation towards critical infrastructure and law. I'm a big fan of us reading materials that are manifested from places outside of technology, and this is one of those. So I definitely encourage you to take a read on it. I actually did a cut and paste directly out of JWT on JSON Web Tokens. Here's the thing. I hope that I'm not, because I put my disclaimer at the bottom, I hope that I'm not offending anybody when it kind of relates to the credential space, signatures, claims. But encryption, signatures, and claims, they are not identity security. They're a very critical component. And I am a big, big fan of, verifiable credentials, verifiable claims. But there's a disconnect, which is all of the history that I just shared with you, right? How do we introduce a capability from a credential standpoint that we do not run into a problem, that I cannot phrase more elegantly than my mentor and my friend, and probably one of the key personalities in identity over the last 25 years, Andre Durand at Ping Identity. Andre said, if you authenticate the wrong person, you still have a bad day. And this is strongly associated to what I'm saying here, which is all of the credentials, all of the verification components, all of the encryption that's associated with an identity that is not the correct identity upon authentication, none of that saves us from the bad day. Right. And so I think that there's a deeper dive that we all need to do around. And I love, Kimberly, the way that you framed up, what the three distinct interests are here. Right. The three distinct interests within this organization about what gets you fascinated, excited, motivated about, credentials. It's the bringing of these three motivations together that begins to put us on the pathway to true identity security. Now, I'm very big vision focused around this because I worked in the weeds of identity for so long. I operate off of a simple mission statement, a personal mission statement, which is my job is to make the digital world safer for everybody. I believe that that job starts very much with identity, from day one. So bringing, the three components of interest together just in this group is exactly what I'm talking about, because credentials and their association to identity and how we achieve security is the way that we've got to be building our structures, because these things in isolation, plus another problem that I'll talk about in just a second, these things in isolation do not provide security because they do not have the full context of what we're available to create about identities today. But when you apply these capabilities to a fully contextually aware identity, then we get security. The one thing that I would mention just a second about encryption. I really strongly encourage you, go look up dynamic encryption, first posited by a professor in Scandinavia in an academic paper in 2015, I believe. I'm sorry that I don't have a reference to it. I know of two companies currently that are working on dynamic encryption. But look, the real problem with our dependencies on it's not claims and credentials that are the problem, per se. It's the fact that they're still relying on things like AES, which was introduced more than 20 years ago, and keys and secrets that are associated with, a key holder and a key store. And they're static, right? So once I get a hold of these, you know, these credentials or these keys, then I can just, you know, simply use them for bad things. So I would definitely encourage you to take a look at dynamic encryption and start thinking about how the world's going to potentially move that direction once we solve some, you know, challenging overhead problems. But encryption in its current stage is just simply problematic because all I got to do is steal your keys. So won't belabor the point. Talk just a little bit. I try and put this in the simplest format, but this is just a re-emphasis of the statement that I made earlier. If I authenticate and I'm not you, I get your stuff. This goes beyond, right? We're identity ascription is a thing. I work in API security. We assign a UID to every API, right? We're treating an API as an identity and credentialed thing, right? I don't like the use of human and non-human actors because actually everything in the digital is non-human. Your account, we just had this conversation, if somebody tried to log on and their credentials were not them, right? You are not your credentials. And they are a proxy for you in the digital world. If they're a proxy for you and you're human, cool, you're a user, right? If they're a proxy for you and it's a functional account, then you're a functional ID, right? But all of them are still dependent upon the same process flow unless authentication is left out. It's a fully authenticated and naked and exposed call. Authentication happens. For the most part, authentication is a one and done, right? Which obviously introduces, you know, problems with actor in the middle and a number of other issues. But when we look at the span of authentication and the never-ending story, which tends to be the implied and persistent trust of an open session, continuously open. Like, I love people telling me, you know, my identity security shop is awesome. And then I log into their Wi-Fi system and their guest Wi-Fi and it said, would you like to keep this connection for 5 days? That ain't ZT, right? A persistent session is not zero trust. And frankly, it's not defense in depth. But this idea of a never-ending story or never-ending session has persisted in our technology system now for decades. Why? Because it's easier for the user. Go back to what I said earlier. If it's easier for the user, it's easier for the bad guys, right? And there's, when I say pretty much nothing, it has some ties to what we're going to share in just a second, but I do want to kind of put a point on this. When we talk about, you know, the exposure that our credentials and our verification aspects and our tokens and everything else that's associated with our online accesses, when we talk about them, look, folks, the damage is real here. Like, the most attacked information on the web for the last decade has been identity-related information. This is not anything that has no explanation to it, right? The reason why people are stealing all of this data is to create the data that's necessary for them to spoof identities, right? Another problem of mine, we don't use security language when we talk about identity. We don't talk about spoofing and non-repudiation. However, if you immediately, you know, kind of associate all of the kind of data that I'm talking about here and how it's used to do password resets and account takeovers and fraudulent account creation and all of these different kind of aspects, you immediately, you know, if you've spent some time in security, you can immediately make that connection between, spoofing and non-repudiation. Here's a basket of information that creates the possibility to both spoof and create multiple identities associated with a singular user, right? So these damages are real. But I talked, you know, about the you know, nothing going on in here between authentication and the never-ending story of open sessions. And it's, you know, it's interesting because APIs – and I'm going to be, you know, real conscious of time here and try and wrap in case there's questions. The reality is that the fuel for APIs is authorization, right? So, you know, there's a cursory authentication call for APIs today, but there's nothing for authorization layer security. There are no security solution providers that have built authorization layer security specifically. If we're doing authorization layer security, it tends to be best efforts, maybe some rules and policies. But here's the problem. APIs are now the universal attack vector. Every attack that I used to have expertise and, you know, some amount of tech access to, I can now do with APIs. So this now starts to get into Act 3, Layer 7, API access. And because APIs are exploding, and because they are an identity, and because they are accessing assets, think about the problem it creates when we have no authorization layer security, and now these APIs are in here picking off specific data elements, specific microservices, specific assets from an access standpoint. And they could do so like a laser beam. They don't need to, matter of fact, you know, not fear, uncertainty, and doubt. One of the things that, you know, might kind of, you know, put off a light bulb for you. I have worked with a customer who had a massive data exfiltration, and the bad guys never got to core. They simply scraped the payloads and the APIs that were unprotected. And those payloads were achieved through authorization calls. And they aggregated that information, walked out without either setting off a single alarm, because of this notion of APIs as a universal attack vector. So when we think about this layer 7 access space, the thing that I would encourage you to start thinking about as it relates to identity is good principles around layer 7, reducing the attack surface. We're growing APIs exponentially, and nobody in identity is in control of them. Nobody in security is in control of them. That is an ever-increasing and ever-growing attack surface. So we're not just adding the human user element from an identity standpoint. We're adding tens of thousands of actors that are making billions upon billions of calls. Like, imagine how many alarms would go off if one banking customer accessed online banking a billion times in a month. That's happening today in the API world. continuous verification. You know, not just verification at the authentication layer, but verification at the authorization layer. Again, won't belabor the point based on time. And the goal being to stop data breaches at that layer seven. Won't spend time on this. Leave it up so that it's recorded so that you can see it. You can see there's a huge amount of identity related concepts in the dynamic policy considerations for layer seven. Matter of fact, one of the biggest questions that I get is, Richard, after so many years in identity, why did you move to API security? And I said, well, because in 24 months, API security is going to be identity security. I saw the direction that API security was going, and it became very obvious to me that we were going to be able to leverage some security control capabilities, in particular around authorization, that we've never been able to put controls around before. So that said, I think I'm at my last slide. I know we're at 5 minutes to the top of the hour here, so I can drop that and I can stop talking and see if there's any questions.
Thank you so much, Richard. This was really helpful for me. I feel like I've picked up a lot of pieces of security information and how it fits with identity, but I didn't have the context that you just gave us, and even just the simple categorization of administration and access control, like, that was really helpful for me. So thank you very much. And I believe we have Harrison on the queue. Harrison, do you have a question?
Yeah, so Richard, I just want to say thank you. I love this presentation, especially the history part of it. Learned a lot, so thank you. I actually have two questions. So the first question is in regards to authentication. I actually do believe that authentication is one of the biggest problem in the identity and security, since that, you know, you want to make sure it's the right physical being that's in access of the digital identity. So my question there is actually, what are the most promising authentication technologies that you've seen that best balance the trade-off between security and user friction? And sure. My second question is a little bit different, which is, you mentioned that you do believe in decentralized identity and self-sovereign identity. And my question is, why do you believe that? And then also, how do you think decentralized identity and self-sovereign identity can gain market share in the security market in general, despite the challenges such as the architecture things that you mentioned?
So on the authentication piece, I think a lot of things that we're seeing in advanced biometrics, and as well in the efforts around strong authentication that are passwordless, that are associated to what I would call more behavioral authentication, right? As everybody on this call knows, there's 20 interesting and discrete data points that Apple collects off my cell phone at any given time. So much so that, and I've confirmed this with folks over at Apple, so much so they haven't built this system, but if I ever authenticated my cell phone with my left hand, using a face scan, call somebody because I'm dead and my head is in a duffel bag, probably on the side of the road. Because that's not the way that I ever authenticate my phone. The signals, so I didn't talk much about, signals and the whole effort that's kind of going on in signals and events, which I think is another promising area, do run into a bit of a strong authentication problem as it relates to privacy, right? And that's why we haven't seen much of a growth yet, exponentially in all the different ways that we could be improving strong authentication. Things like biometrics are only at the very beginning. But there's a lot of problems in the back end, and I do a lot of work on the legislative side and the regulatory side on figuring out how do you collect that kind of very, very, very specific personal information and not violate current data privacy accords. On the self-sovereign and DID side, DID and self-sovereign, very specifically, I believe that every human being should have a right to prove that they are who they say they are, right? And I think that when we talk about where specifically SSI comes into the equation, I think that my ability to bring my own authenticator, bring my own verified credentials is absolutely correct in a digital world. It is threatening to a lot of people. I think this is the problem that we continuously get in DID and SSI. It's not just the architectural things that I mentioned. DID and SSI is threatening, especially to large corporations, because even though they may not use that really rich information to create a better security solution for you on the strong authentication side, they love keeping all that information about you. And the idea of you having control of some of that information is problematic in current business structures. So I think that there's a huge amount of tension between, corporate business interests and what DID or SSI means, in terms of giving control back to the consumer or the citizen. And I think that we're going to see that tension kind of continue to build. We're seeing really interesting, successful things happening in Africa, and in Australia as it relates to SSI and DID. But I think that that soap opera is going to continue for the next 3 to 5 years before we actually start to see some progress in that space.
Great. Thank you so much, Richard. I know we are at time. I imagine that many of you may have other questions. If you want to send me an email with those questions, I will consolidate them and get them over to Richard. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, and I wish you safe travels wherever you're off to. And thank you, everyone, for coming today, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everyone.